Welcome to Bewildered. I'm Martha Beck, here with Rowan Mangan. At this crazy moment in history, a lot of people are feeling bewildered, but that actually may be a sign we're on track. Human culture teaches us to come to consensus, but nature, our own true nature, helps us come to our senses. Rowan and I believe that the best way to figure it all out is by going through bewilderment into bewilderment. That's why we're here.
So, Marty, I think there's a pretty good chance that our listeners are out there going, oh, wow, I have a lot of cultural messages in my head and it's not that easy to access the voice of my true nature.
Yes.
And yes. I don't know, they might be thinking, is there anything else that I could do other than listening to this podcast to help me learn to listen to my heart?
Well, I had this question. Even as a young child, I would say, I am not happy. And people would say, well, it's all in your head. And I'd be like, I know, get it out of my head. But nobody could really help me do that. And so in my 20s, I sort of made up a system to help me detach from cultural messages and connect with my true nature. And it ended up being my career as a life coach and then training people to do the same thing.
And I think that, you know, it's just like people who feel the urge to heal themselves, help others heal and heal the world, that this term life coach sort of slots into that in our culture. And people take the training to hang out a shingle and become life coaches. People take the training because it's like getting life coaching.
Yeah.
You know, and people also take the training just to learn to access their own true nature.
Yeah. It was originally just an access your own true nature course. Mm-hmm. But when you've mastered that, you really want to share it with other people and people want to be shared with, right, and they will pay you money. So if that's the way you want to go, that's why it ended up being life coach training. But it's actually Wayfinder, which is different. It's about finding your way by connecting with your true nature and steering your own course.
So if people are interested, you can Google Wayfinder Life Coach Training or go to marthabeck.com and you will find your way.
Yes, you will. Hi, I'm Martha Beck.
And I'm Rowan Mangan, and this is another episode of Bewildered, the podcast for people trying to figure it out. How are you doing, Marty?
I'm doing pretty well. It's been a while since we sat down to do this, and it's really fun to be here again, I have to say.
But they don't know that. Our listeners don't know that because of the magic of something. Of, I guess, like regular releases. We're supposed to
deposit them in a special eggery.
Yeah.
They're like eggeries. We put in a little egg podcast.
Have the illusion that we do things regularly, but in fact we don't, as we very often end up saying on
this
show.
We say it like every time and then we say, oh, but they don't know because of the magic of whatever, but we're wrong.
We're wrong.
And they're right. Wrong. Anyway, what are you trying to figure out?
Well, Marty, as so often, what I'm trying to figure out today is what the hell is wrong with me?
Oh, this should be quick.
Right? So, case in point.
Okay.
Don't know if I've ever mentioned this on the show before, but we have a young daughter.
I don't think you've ever said that. No.
No.
Nor have I. We never, ever, ever talk about it.
Well, she's very, like, we don't really notice her very much.
She's so inconspicuous.
Like, yeah.
We give her a low priority.
Yeah, she just sort of sits in the corner quietly most of the time. Anyway, so one of her hobbies at the moment is that she likes to play hide and seek. And I find that bedtime runs a lot more smoothly if we do a little hide and seek first. Little, you know, I scratch her back, she scratches mine.
I didn't know that was part of hide and seek, but now I want to play it again.
You don't want to play it the way she plays it, Marty, because it's terrifying.
What?
Well, I mean, and this is to the what the hell is wrong with me. It shouldn't be terrifying to play hide and seek with your toddler, but here we go. So first of all, playing hide and seek with Lila involves her taking you to the place that she wants you to hide.
Right.
In this instance, her toddler bed. So, which is like a crib with the sides taken off, for those of you who don't know such things. All right. I climb into the toddler bed. And then she says, okay, now I'm going to go and count. She walks out of the room. And here's what she does, though. She starts counting. She's great at counting.
A bit random.
One.
Seven.
But then for some reason, and this is where it starts getting as she gets closer to 10, she starts to whisper the numbers.
Okay.
And I personally find it very disturbing. Like, I can't exactly explain it, but when you go 1, 2, 3, 4, that's one thing. But then when it's like 8, 9. So then she comes in.
Ready or not, here I come.
Well, now and you're scaring me. By the way, ready or not, here I come is a scary threat.
It's a terrible thing to say to a person.
Yeah.
What if your doctor said that to you? Instead of knocking on the door, they just stood outside and went, ready or not, here I come.
Marty, I feel like it would be wrong if we didn't take a break at this point to let you tell a doctor joke that you recently read in a David Sedaris book.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, I absolutely
think. This is a family show. Okay.
No, it is not. It's an adults-only show.
So this is a joke from David Sedaris' book, A Carnival of Snackery. And to give full attribution, he heard it from Phyllis Diller. And now you're hearing it from me. Here's the joke. A man goes to the doctor. Doctor says to the patient, you're going to need to stop masturbating. And the man says, why? And the doctor says, so I can examine you. End of joke. It did make me laugh and laugh, I have to say. Wait, one of my favorite jokes.
It's a wonderful joke. How did I get to that from Hide and Seek Without Talking?
I said, if the doctor stopped outside the examination room and said, ready or not, here I come.
Here I come.
That would be really genuinely terrifying. Yeah. Yeah, it's a Clarice situation. It's not good. So go on. What does our daughter do?
So she understands that the first part of how to play hide and seek when you know full well where the person's hiding is that you walk into the room and you talk loudly about where they aren't. And so she's like, I wonder where my mummy is, Clarice. And she's like, is she? And she just thinks of really lame places like right here in the middle of the room. No. Anyway, there's just a point where she does that for a while and I'm under the covers, right? I'm hiding under the covers in this tiny, tiny bed all scrunched up awkwardly. But then,
yes,
like as the game builds, something like I think I go into like a kind of prey predator kind of all dynamic.
Right. All right.
And I start and I feel like my hands are starting to get clammy. The kid knows where I am.
Yeah, yeah.
She's told me to be there.
Well, that's why it's so frightening.
And then there's this point where she just goes silent. And Marty, it's so scary. Like I am like my heart's beating and I'm under there and I'm like trying to listen to see if I can hear her footsteps and if they're approaching.
Oh my
and
God.
I'm just in my head, the words are ringing, ready or not, here I come.
We may need to consider getting some nanny help. Not for her, for you.
I need someone to just sit by me and rub my forehead.
Wouldn't that be great? Who said, who was it? Is it Amy Schumer that says, if you want to have fun in New York, just hire a babysitter for yourself? they let you play with their cell phones and they charge very little money. Anyway.
So, there is a moment where you do start to hear the toddler breath in your ear and it is absolutely terrifying. And that's all I have to say about that because I'm a really well-adjusted and a good parent and I am fine.
You know she's gonna prey upon you. I mean, because you are in a prey relationship with her, she is going to go predator. By the time she's a teenager, you are not going to believe the things she does when you're ready or not. This is what I think. I think you have to stop being afraid, but right now. How's that helping? You look disturbed.
I know. I feel like he just like looked into my eyes and said,
ready or not, here I come. Yeah, you can't help but play with it. If you're going to be that, yeah. If your threshold of fear is that low, things are going to want to play on it. I'm just saying.
All right. Well, I will continue to work on it. What are you trying to figure out?
Well, I'm trying to figure out how to live without caffeine, which is a horrible, horrible thing.
There's no solution to that.
Like my doctor quite literally said, you should not drink caffeine. And I was going to say, why? And she would say, so I can examine you. But you jumped the gun.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's all
right. I didn't think you had known to go there.
I was going to go there. And you were like, ready or not, here I go. I'm going to give you the joke you're about to give. Anyway, so I came on. It's bad enough to have to live without caffeine. It's horrible. You know, we get up in the morning. We are not morning people. Karen, our beloved Carrie Koo, is a morning person. Thank God.
Thank God.
Because Carrie Koo has done all the morning things in our lives for a long time now. And so many people are morning people, and they really, really need to stop. Anyway, all babies are morning people. So we have relied heavily on coffee. And we have coffee down to a science. We've got really good coffee, right?
Yeah.
And now I can't have caffeine.
Yeah.
So I get up in the morning. I was like, cuckoo, I can't have caffeine. The doctor said I can't have caffeine until I can't have my coffee. And Karen said, it's fine. I'll get you a cup of tea. If you drink two of them, it's as strong as coffee. And I said, yeah, because of the caffeine, which I'm not allowed to have. She's like, all right, well, Coca-Cola has some caffeine in it. I could get you that. And I was like, again, Karen, the issue is not how is the caffeine delivered. The issue is I can't have caffeine in any form. But it drives her. She's so sweet. She wants me to have whatever I want. Yes, and I want caffeine. Yes. So she keeps trying to deliver caffeine to me in disguise.
Yeah, she's trying to trick you into doing what your doctor said not to do.
The sad thing and the painful thing for everyone in the family, I think, is the look of stricken disappointment on her little face every time she tells me another thing that's full of caffeine that I could now eat because it's not the other things. And I have to say to her, no, Carrie Koo, it's the caffeine itself. Yeah, but she did recently show us a picture of a southern flannel moth caterpillar that would probably make me wake up out of sheer terror.
So that's something she's got going for her.
I have to say this. I should have saved it for another podcast, but I'm brimming with the knowledge.
I knew this was going to happen.
The southern flannel moth caterpillar, also called the tree asp. As in the kind of snake that killed Cleopatra, because it is one of the most venomous creatures in North America, and it looks like a blonde Elvis. It's got this big pompadour of fur, and it just wiggles around, and then it turns into a moth that looks like a bunny rabbit. Violently poisonous. Never touch a caterpillar, especially if it's furry. That's what I have to say about that.
We had a caterpillar, a really big caterpillar that tried to break into our house.
Yes.
In Africa. In South Africa.
I heard it going, ready or not, here I come.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it tried to come in. It was huge.
It successfully came in through a closed door. We don't know how.
And then Ro did try to sloop it out with a stick.
I was being butch that day.
And it freaked
oh my God.
Out. This 6-inch long caterpillar and meaty. It was a meaty caterpillar. And it had this weird little conniption fit, like a seizure.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I'll ever sleep again.
No, it brought me to my knees.
And then there was a spider the size of my hand. Yeah. And then later in the same place on the same curtain, a huge ass scorpion.
Yeah, we were like channeling some big, powerful animal medicine energy that day.
Yeah, we wanted big animals. We did not get the elephants. We got the damn caterpillar. But they were terrifying. We got terrifying, huge, tiny animals.
Yeah, we got huge versions of tiny animals. That's so interesting.
Mm. That would be a good title for a book. Huge versions of tiny animals. If only we'd had tiny versions of huge animals, we would have had an elephant in a teacup instead of the spider.
I want a giraffe in a teacup.
Oh, that would be so cute. But it would kind of obviate the whole purpose of a giraffe, right? Which is to be tall.
Well, and the whole point of a cup of tea. Which not have a giraffe in it.
Seriously, I promised to get off this topic, but when our friend Boyd came to get the spider for us, because we had to call someone to come get the spider, he brought a teacup. And even his sister Bronwyn, who grew up in South Africa on the reserve with him, even she looked at him and said, Boydie, you're going to need a bigger cup. It was bigger than a teacup.
Marty.
What?
I just love that you are so hypocritical that you can tell that story without even mentioning that maybe 3-4 years earlier in the same room.
Oh, God, this. I had repressed this and now hear it. Ready or not.
Well, guess what? Some of us can't repress it because we're not.
Better tell the people.
She gave me spider coffee.
Oh, I did.
It was, and like, this is not a small spider. Like, okay, so yes, my beloved made me a cup of coffee first thing in the morning.
First thing in the morning.
Very sweet of her.
Not a morning person.
Not a morning person. Doesn't necessarily check the bottom of the cup.
Who does?
The white. It's white on the inside. That spider was brown, dude. And it was huge. Like, it was the same kind of spider that later you made a big fuss about being on the curtains. That was true. In my goddamn coffee, Marty.
I know. And the worst thing is, okay, the worst thing is it wasn't at the top. It was at the bottom and you drank the coffee.
And then a big leg kind of floated out of the gloom of the coffee.
Oh, it was disgusting.
It... God, you are so lucky you repressed that.
No, I don't want to hurt our spider fans, but God, that was disgusting.
That was awful.
That was let's do a podcast. Let's stop reminiscing about things that make us want to hurt ourselves and let's just make a podcast. What do you say?
Let's do it. All right. It's pretty crazy, but it just might work.
We'll be right back
with more Bewildered. I have a favor to ask. You might not know this, but ratings and reviews are like gold in the podcasting universe. They get podcasts in front of more faces, more eyes, more ears, all the bits that you could have a podcast in front of, that's what they do. So it would help us enormously if you would consider going over to your favorite podcasting app, especially if it's Apple, and giving us a few stars, maybe even 5. Maybe even 6. If you can find a way to hack the system, I wouldn't complain. And a review would also be wonderful. We read them all and love them. So thank you very much in advance. Let's just go out there and bewilder the world. Mwah. Change, eh?
It sure does keep happening.
I feel like there's something that you, Martha Beck, have created that will help us understand how change affects us and how to manage it.
Oh, by coincidence, now that you mention it, I have. It's called the change cycle. Mm. It's about 4 aspects of the whole process of change. And we've put the information together in one handy place so that the people can refer to it when they're going through change.
And you know what else? We also made podcast episodes about each of the 4 squares in the cycle that are also on this new page that we've made for the peoples.
Well, how remarkable is that? All right, you can find out all about the change cycle at marthabeck.com/change.
So we are actually doing a Bewild Files episode today.
Whoop, whoop.
And that's nice, which means that we get to hear from y'all, our beloveds out in the listening world of listeners. Hmm. And today that person is Celestine.
Celestine!
Hi, Ro and Marty. My name is Celestine. What I'm trying to figure out is when to stop trying to figure it out. I have spent the last 12 months in bug soup, dissolving all the different areas of my life, and I'm starting to see the path of the future, but the control freak in me wants to show up and plan it out, break it down, make an action plan. And there's another part of me that now understands that it's just my job to show up and watch it unfold. So where do you find the balance?
Celestine talks about bug soup, one of my favorite expressions in the English language. And a central term, I think it would be fair to say, in Martha's work.
Yeah.
So in Wayfinder Life Coach Training, which she developed once upon a time.
I keep developing it.
Yeah, it's a development.
I just keep developing it.
And it is sort of loosely based around this brilliant concept of the change cycle that she made up in her own little head. And
it was data grounded. It was data grounded. I went to Harvard. Ooh. I didn't say it. They don't get to drink. I didn't say it. You said it.
Say it again.
No, don't say it. Keep going. Tell them about this loose metaphor, or do you want me to do it?
When you said, say it again, it made me think that the listeners are probably going to think that that's what you want to hear in bed. All right. Just say Ivy League.
Say Ivy League. You know, it just occurred to me that what I gave you in Africa, what I made for you, is what you just said is one of your favorite things. And that was literally spider soup.
Oh my
spider
God.
Coffee, bug soup. What really is the difference?
Oh, wow.
See, you manifested it. Stop thinking these thoughts. They manifest.
Wow. They manifest 4 years ago.
Yeah, they did.
Time is an illusion. All right. So The Change Cycle.
Yes.
By Martha Beck. It is a four-stage description of how we all go through change. Is that fair?
Yes.
For me to say that.
Yes.
So once upon a time, we did an episode of this podcast called A Space for Dreaming.
Mm.
And in that episode, we talked about the second part of that.
Yes.
Which, so Marty calls it square one, square two, square three, and get this, square four. Mm. So the space for dreaming was about square two. We're going to go backwards today and talk about what Celestine is referring to when she says bug soup.
All right. So a change occurs when something hits your life that does not allow you to remain the same. So it could be a shock like a loss, or it could be an opportunity like a job interview or whatever, or it could be just growth that you just outgrow your life. Anyway, for a caterpillar like the one that assaulted us that day, it's the thing that triggers it to go into its little change, big metamorphosis, is that it gets full fed. And that means that it has the same bulk as the eventual butterfly or moth. It has exactly, but they you know, it has to grow until it's big enough to make a whole butterfly. And then something inside it gets triggered.
This is literally true, what she's saying right now.
This is literally true. And that full-fed caterpillar will make a cocoon and he'll just lie inside there. And I used to think they just lay in there, growing long legs and wings, but they don't. They disintegrate, at least many species disintegrate inside the cocoon until there are no two molecules that are hanging together anymore. And then it triggers that condition, triggers something called the imago cells. And the same cells are now reorganized and regrouped into a butterfly. It's like you took a person made of Legos, and then you took apart every Lego from every other Lego, and then you made a totally different shape out of exactly the same number of Legos, right? Mm. So this meltdown process is what happens to us when we hit a place in our life where we can't go on being what we've been before, and we don't like it much.
Mm-mm.
And we don't resist, we don't accept it, we resist it, and our culture doesn't even have language for it. So when it happens to you, when your life is hit, like classic thing that affected us all, the pandemic, right?
Mm-hmm.
COVID-19 spreads across the world, everything shuts down. Nobody could be what they were before that. Mm. And so there was a huge period of not knowing what to be. And it's this ego dissolution, this feeling of everything falling apart, that is a signal that we've gone into a new metamorphosis. And for us, it could happen, you know, for a caterpillar, it happens once. For us, it could happen dozens, hundreds of times, I suppose. But that dissolving part has to happen, and people resist that like crazy.
So the dissolving, you said ego dissolution. So, yeah. But so what, where we feel it is in our sense of identity.
Right.
So that sense of who I was, I can no longer be. And yeah. then what Celestine's talking about is that period of time where the new thing hasn't come yet.
Yeah.
And we are bug soup. We are spider coffee.
Yeah. Even worse than the spider coffee. At least the spider still looked like a spider, though it was dead. But really, like, if you just kept cooking it until it all came apart.
No.
Okay, this is bad. Well, this is the thing. It's not fun to dissolve something, to let something fall apart. It is death-like. It is the death of what we were. And our culture is very frightened of death. We should talk about what the culture says about all this anyway.
Yeah, I mean, we've discussed before that the culture does not really like change, doesn't really acknowledge it, doesn't really accept it.
Except like change for the better. You know, there are certain things. Every day and every way I'm getting better and better. That's like the one thing we're allowed to do.
That's true. There's absolutely no room for this process, this natural process that does happen many times. There's no, like you say, there's no language for it. There's no space made for it. So I think like the first thing, if we're talking about this square one, this death and rebirth process that we'll all go through in our lives, it feels really important to me that our first priority is to make that space, because it's kind of big, and when it happens, you kind of got to let it happen.
Yeah. And you put it once, you said you have to insist on your right to melt down.
Yeah.
Because the world around you, at least in our culture, is not going to be supportive of it. And so you run a very high risk of having internalized beliefs that say this is not okay. So if the reality is that everything's melting down, things fall apart, the center cannot hold and all that, if you quote Yeats, then you're going to be really, really stressed as you fall apart, thinking, I must not fall apart. And everyone around you going, you must not fall apart. But the reality is you're melting, and it just happens.
So the melting can happen in a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. And even in just in certain parts of our lives, like you could be sort of more or less have your shit together with your family and at home and your relationships and stuff, but you might be in a square one with work where you're just like, no, this isn't serving me anymore. I need something new, but I don't know what it is yet. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about like a really massive square one that I had recently.
Okay. Were you full fed?
That's funny, because I had a baby, and just before that baby came out, I do not think I've ever felt more full fed.
Yeah.
I was full of baby.
Yeah, you were full of baby.
Ooh. So there's this lovely term that people are starting to use, which is matrescence, and it's the process of becoming a mother. From not being a mother to being a mother. And what's lovely about it is, like, adolescence or senescence, you mentioned, it's a period of time. It's not a like toggle switch from not to that.
It's not yesterday I was a caterpillar and today I'm a butterfly. No.
Exactly. And what was interesting to me about this square one for me is that I had my daughter late, by most biological standards. I was 40. I'd just turned 40 when she was born. So I'd had a lot of life before becoming a mother.
Mm-hmm.
I was very conscious that I wanted to do it. I prepared for it. I could not have been told more explicitly or more times that this thing I was doing would change my life wholly and utterly, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the bit I wasn't prepared for, though, was the bit where it changed my life wholly and utterly and irrevocably and freaking every second of my life.
Yep.
Is different now. And not, and because I'm different. And, mm-hmm. and a whole new self was given birth to. And so she's coming up to three, and I still feel like I am right in the middle of that particular bug soup experience. Yep. And I don't know when I take form again after this, in the part of my life where parenting, motherhood lives. I know I won't be the same as before. I won't be what I am right now, which is an absolute freaking mess.
I will be. I always am.
Well, I mean, you know, I'll still be me.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I definitely will have new pieces to integrate into myself, which are being born and being melted every day, every week,
you know,
as we go forward. So
yeah, they change so fast when they're little babies that you just as you get used to one stage, they're another stage.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how hard we try to hang on to the previous stages.
That's so true.
I call it grabbing backwards.
Yeah.
And grabbing backwards is something that I can feel myself doing very often. And I've been actually doing it a lot since we went off to, I was working on my chapter book and my picture book. I was working on creating the illustrations for a children's book. Plus I'm working on a nonfiction book that I'm actually under contract to create. And I was like on fire with my research and my the momentum of writing, and I was drawing all these pictures, and then I was getting up at 4 and doing things, and I just had to put it all on pause, go to Africa for a month. And I resisted that too, because it was like, no, I don't want to, my life is so great right now. Then we get to Africa, and of course to South Africa, we're seeing our friends, we're out in the bush, and it was wonderful, and I completely let go. And just like every single time, you every trip is always going to be new, right? So it was this completely brand new experience. And I thought, oh, good that I put my life on pause. We've been back for weeks and weeks. And I just today realized I cannot be the person I was before I left. I have to approach the book. I mean, I read what I'd written before I left and I went, oh yeah, this is bad. Started the book over after writing the first 100 pages. Had to start a whole new, like I looked at my art supplies and thought, I actually don't know how to use those. I have no idea what to do with them. So I've been grabbing backwards for weeks now and it doesn't work. I forgot to just let myself melt. But even something small like that, I grab backwards for my identity.
So your writing career is in bug soup at the moment, or maybe is just starting to give you some hints.
Yeah, this book the book became bug soup, even though it's on the same topic. It had to be completely different.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I love this idea of grabbing backwards, because we don't think we're grabbing backwards. We think we're sustaining forwards.
Yep.
But there isn't that, because there is only the present. And so that's a cool way of conceptualizing it, I think.
Yeah.
But how do we figure this out, this bug soup, square one mess?
Yes, it's a mess. It's a spider in a cup of coffee. And I will tell you how to fix it, or we will tell you how to fix it, or we won't, but we will do it all in a minute.
Hello, the lovely peoples. This is Martha, inviting you to a free masterclass that I have made called 5 Paths to Your Purpose. Probably the most common question I get from people is, how do I find my purpose? Why don't I feel that I'm on purpose? Well, it turns out there are certain things you have to do to find your purpose, and I broke them down into 5, and I made a little masterclass about it. So if you'd like to see it, just go to marthabeck.com/purpose and you will be able to watch it without any charge at all.
So why is it then do you think that we need to continuously die and be reborn in this way through our lives? Why does this happen?
Yeah, you mentioned the whole square one thing, and I always say that's the place of death and rebirth. And you can't stop either one. I mean, everything's always dying, and everything's always, something new is always being born, because nature, like we compare culture and nature, and the culture says, get to a state of perfection and then hold that, right, you know, and die looking good with a lot of toys. But nature never, ever stops changing. You are, you know, your fingernails are longer than they were when you started listening to this podcast. You're a little bit closer to your own death. I'm sorry. That's a good podcast. Yeah, ready or not. But seriously, everything's always in flow, and we get attached to a state of being, and we say that is reality. And then when it continues to change, it's like, what? No, don't let it change. We need to hold this state of being. And it's almost like our whole culture is about trying to hang on to what cannot ever stop leaving and arriving. You know, our reputations, our legacies, our lives, they're all just dust in the wind, right?
Right. So because there's only the present, and the present is only ever change, like the reality of change, it's like we get stuck in a state of grabbing backwards, because that's what we're doing when we think we're staying the same. Is that right?
Yeah. And I think there's two ways. It's either regret or anxiety. The regret is, oh, I looked so much better a year ago. I've got to get back to that. Mm-hmm. And the anxiety is, shoot, I look like this now. What am I going to look like in another year? Like, the continuous change thing is not so much fun when you're out of your, you'll see this, when you're out of your 40s, it becomes a real debacle. It's like,
well, I personally won't be leaving my 40s.
Yeah, you'll look exactly the same. Yeah, it's like, it was Pema Chodron, the Buddhist nun, says, we somehow really believe that our skin, our hair, our teeth will never change, like not like an older person.
Yeah.
And then we get old and it's a complete surprise. It's just like having a baby. You know it's coming and it's a total shock.
Yeah.
So actually, they say one of the, I saw this thing on Senescence, speaking of essences, and they said the single most common reaction to being old, like when they talk to people who are over 100, is that they are shocked that they aged. And I think I have a reason for that, but I'm going to say it in a minute. But anyway, it's like, I was looking, we watched a show the other day with Shirley MacLaine in it, and she was playing this role, and she's 89 years old when she recorded the show. And I remembered seeing her get an Academy Award in like her 50s and talk about how hard it was for her to age. And the whole room kind of went quiet, like she was speaking the unspeakable in this room full of Hollywood perfect stars. And then I saw her at 89 and I was like, you're magnificent. But who is she? Is she the teenage person that started acting? Is she a baby? Is she the glamorous 30-year-old? Is she the 50-year-old saying it's hard to age? Is she the 89-year-old? Yes. She's all of them.
Yeah. Is there something about how we perceive when we're very young that someone's age is somehow feels intrinsic to their identity? Like, I remember saying to my father, like, I was quite young, and I said something about how old people dress. Like, I had this idea that once you reached a certain age, you had to put on old people clothes.
And is that not true? Wait, what?
Well, and I said to him, like, why would you never see an old person in jeans? And he's like, well, I'm going to get old and I'm going to wear jeans. And now he is, and he does. So so the prophecy was,
fulfilled.
It was fulfilled. There's the word. I was like, what is a prophecy? And so, yeah, I feel like I have this habit of thinking about identity and age, and probably lots of other things as well, as being linked. And then, yeah, you see a gap like that.
Yeah.
And it's confusing to something about our minds.
We see statuses, like that is who that person is. And it goes all the way through. And then wait 10 years, they're completely different. And you're like, whoa, that was, or I wonder why they let that happen. I certainly won't let it happen to me. Yeah. But I guess they are like that now.
Yeah, that's it. It's like, it's such a funny thing that seems to be like a tendency of how we think. This isn't even in a nature culture kind of basket situation. It's like there's just this tendency to, I think it's like, all right, weird sort of metaphor incoming. Mm. Because we're trapped in bodies, right? Mm-hmm. We experience what's a flow of change as like one of those flip books where it becomes like a little guy walking along. You know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm, that you flip through the little book and the cartoon seems to move because it's just incremental progressions. And there's a something sort of staccato-y about it. And so for us, because we're stuck in the matter of our bodies, we are experiencing it as death, rebirth, death, rebirth. Rebirth, like, oh, I'm falling apart. Oh, I'm bug soup. Oh, I'm coming back together.
Right, right, right.
But actually, that's the illusion. And what it actually is just movement and flow and this sweet, beautiful, constant flow. It's just, there's just this strange aperture that we look at it by because we haven't got a great perspective on what's happening.
Why does the aperture feel like calming, like this will sustain? And when you say it's a sweet, beautiful flow, it sounds so nice. But if you say, yeah, you're older than you were 5 minutes ago, and you're just going to keep getting older forever, and then you'll die and decay and be gone. You can say that sweet and beautiful, but at least in our culture, again, I have other cultural references, but like the idea of the stasis is comforting, even though it's absolutely observably not real. Yeah. Where the idea of continuous change is like, even though it is the only thing that is for sure.
It's like maybe it's to do with that left hemisphere stuff that you've told me about, where the left hemisphere, which is the side of the brain that our culture favors, its tendency is to slice things into smaller and smaller pieces, because that's
analysis means to cut things up.
And so I wonder if we just want a slice, we just want one 2D image. We don't want something that can dance. We want something that we can frame and hang on the wall.
You know, it is fascinating because according to Ian McGilchrist, my favorite neurologist in the world, the left side of the brain is also responsible for the actual hand movement of reaching out and grabbing. It wants to grab.
Grabbing
backwards.
So we talk
about grabbing backwards. So it has this slices of time and it wants to grab a slice and hold it. And it also has this feeling of itself being the only right thing.
Yeah.
Whereas the right hemisphere is what's responsible for just observing with awe the continuous fluid movement of everything.
So maybe what it is that it's just like what we are is like waves, but the way we experience ourselves is as particles, if that makes sense. So what feels like death, rebirth, you know, or meltdown or new identity or change or it's all I can't, it's different. It's actually just a single, you know, wave coming into shore or moving.
You are blowing my mind right now, because this is saying that we feel like a particle even though we're a wave. It really puts it into an interesting space for me because of the whole Heisenberg uncertainty principle thing. You know that?
Yeah, but, you know, sort of.
I will talk a little. I'm sure I've talked about this before. It's been called the most elegant experiment.
You're
going to
double slip me right now.
Oh my God, that sounds filthy. You're going to have to stop doing that so that we can make a podcast.
Stop double slitting.
Okay. There was an experiment that had nothing to do with sex. It had to do with light particles, with photons. They created a barrier with two slits cut in it, and they shot these photons at the barrier, boom, 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 and they would land, the photons would land on a photographic plate behind the two slits. I won't go into massive detail. Look it up if you're not familiar with it. It's amazing. bottom line, if they weren't measuring to see, or if they weren't looking to see which slit the particle went through, if they just went away and ran the machine without looking, the way that the light particles hit the photographic sheet was dispersed the way waves are in water. It was clearly showing that the light was like a wave going through a sieve, and it was separating out into the pattern that is characteristic of a fluid, right? But if they watched, then the photons would just go through one slit or the other and just make two bars on the photographic plate. And what they, this was discovered in like 1913. It's been known for a long time. But what they realized is that when it is being observed, the light particle and potentially all particles act like chunks of matter, like pinpoints of stuff. But if consciousness is not observing them, they array like a wave. In other words, when you look away, I mean, imagine this. This is not part of the experiment, but I often imagine this, that every time you look away, whatever's behind you just disintegrates into energy. But the moment you look back, it hardens again into matter.
Oh my God.
It's not actually that far away from the implications of the double slit experiment.
What? Yeah. Like, I don't know if this is a bad idea to ask you this, but like, how do you take in the implications of this idea that the observation of consciousness fundamentally changes the nature of the universe?
Well, I remember reading this in a physics book a long time ago, and it explained the experiment, and then it explained the implications, and then it said, if after reading this you do not feel as if the earth has disappeared from beneath your feet, yeah, go read it again. And I did. And here's the thing, you have to accept that we are fundamentally paradoxical. So trying to accept ourselves as waves doesn't really work, because we experience ourselves as matter, but experiencing ourselves as matter doesn't work because we're constantly fluidly changing like a wave, because we are both. And that means we are either or, we are both at once, and we are neither one, all at the same time. And so it suspends your brain in a state that I think is what people are after in Asia when they talk about don't know mind, or the perfectly clear mind of consciousness. Everything, it is completely still itself, but it is also the source of all movement. It is, it contains all matter, but it has no matter at all.
If it weren't for the still point, there would be no dance, but there is only the dance.
Yes, we are still and still moving. Everything, the dance and the stillness are the same thing. Consciousness, maybe consciousness is the still thing, and within it, everything is always changing. And maybe that's why we're so confused about the fact that we're constantly changing, because the part of us that is thinking about it is actually consciousness, which maybe does not change, but is eternal, that is existing outside of the flow of time. And so the flow of time doesn't make sense to consciousness, because it gets diluted into thinking it's matter.
Yeah.
I don't know. I start to feel like a talking golden retriever.
Yeah, I sort of, you start to look a bit like one too.
Thank you.
It's because of like my consciousness is observing you and you're turning into a golden retriever, as all things do.
Theoretically, something could just turn into a golden retriever and then back again. And that would just be a matter of statistically improbable things happening. Very improbable, but it could happen.
Yeah. Like a whale in midair or a bowl of petunias. So let me ask you this then.
Okay.
You think, I'm just going to put aside the whole mind-boggling crap you just laid on us. Do you think that we experience death, rebirth metaphorically through our lives in the form of unwelcome change, because our job here is to practice or to learn how to let go?
Because that would be the opposite of grabbing, isn't it? Like grabbing, just like open those hands and let go all the time.
Right. And if it's like, you know, Ram Dass says we're all just walking each other home, if it's like maybe we're learning how to
let go. It's an interesting idea, because then after you're dead, then you would you still have to know how? Or is it all a rehearsal for death? This brings to mind a story that I want to tell our listeners. And okay. it was an interesting thing. You were there. We were on a plane. I believe we were coming back from Europe, South Africa. I don't remember where we were, but we were coming home.
We were okay. Yeah.
I think we were on the plane from London to Philadelphia or something. Yeah. Anyway, I bought in the airport this book called In Love with the World by a Tibetan monk named Yonge Mingur Rinpoche. And I'm reading the book, and it's all about how he grew up, and his father was a great teacher. And he would say things when he was two or three, like, I want a tricycle. And his father would say, well, you know, that just rusts and degrades, right? Everything dies. Everything's impermanent. Just get that through your little three-year-old head. And it was spoken of in a loving way, but I thought, dude, that is harsh. Like, you're telling this to a toddler. Like, we go get Lila and just say, this is, want to see something dead? That's going to happen to you. Like, that is not how our culture does it. No. So I was quite put off by it, frankly, even though he's a beautiful writer. And he would talk about this, how in a lot of Tibetan households, everybody drinks a cup of tea at night and then turns the cup upside down and puts it by the bed to say, this day has gone. It's dead. This day is dead. And in the morning, if you wake up, if you say, oh, another day, and you turn the cup upright to receive what's coming now, but it's a totally different life, right? I thought, well, that's really interesting. And I stopped reading, and we were playing with this little girl, this beautiful British family, parents with two kids, a little maybe four-year-old and a baby, and they were so adorable. Remember those kids? And you were thinking about having a baby, and we were like, oh my God, that's so adorable. And I started to talk to the mother, and I said, what are you doing in Philadelphia? And she said, we're going to a special hospital because my oldest here has a terminal illness that nobody understands. Only 40 people in the world have it. And they want to study her brain as it decays until she's dead.
Yeah.
And it was so surreal. But what the other thing that was going on is that I had noticed from the moment I got on the plane that the crew was bizarrely nice. They were like, I mean, there a lot of crews are very polite, but these people were over the top, remember? They're like, can I bring you some tea? Can I bring you some coffee? And I was like, I can't have caffeine. Why are you hurting me? No, I could. But they were like, really? Can I bring you anything? It felt weirdly sincere.
Yeah.
And so I kept talking to this little girl's mother. I mean, what do you say? I was just like, gah. And then she said, the crew knows. And they're doing everything they can to make this is her big airplane trip of her life.
I think the airline had like sponsored the family for the flight. So,
That's right. So they were getting help. They were, you know, he was like a salesman or something. They didn't have much money. But there was so much love coming from the crew, coming from these parents who had accepted their fate, and the love for that child. They weren't holding it back one iota. They were there, totally present. And then as this sort of spread through the plane, the whole plane full of people started to get loving. Like, oh, this is all she gets? Oh my God, we're going to love this. We are going to love this. And I got home that night, I drank some herb tea, turned my cup upside down, and I let it die. Let the day die. Let's see what's born tomorrow.
Yeah, because, I mean, it really, with the story of the little girl, you can feel how futile the urge to grab backwards is, and yet so how hard. Human it is, right? So to hard. Be there in the presence of this beautiful child and be so obsessed with what you know. Yeah. Is going to happen to her, even though it's completely abstract in the present moment.
Yeah.
She's just exactly what she looks like, a happy little girl. It's like we want to grab backwards, even from a perfection.
Yeah. Yeah. We want it to stay. And that, but that is the opposite of joy. What I think we were seeing there and what Mingo Rinpoche was trying to say is when you let it flow, when you are continuously letting go, that's when the beauty can reach you. That's when you're in reality and reality is kind.
And so I guess for Celestine's question.
Oh, Celestine, right. Hi, Celestine.
So you just keep letting go. Just let go, let go, let go, let go, let go. And the river is going to take you where it's going to take you.
I would, and if you try to stop it, if you grab backwards, it actually slows the process down and makes it hard. But if you can park yourself, I think, in consciousness and watch it unfold the way you would watch a caterpillar on YouTube going through metamorphosis, just be fascinated. Don't try to control it. You can't. It's nature.
And that's why we continuously say,
stay wild.
We hope you're enjoying Bewildered. If you're in the USA and want to be notified when a new episode comes out, text the word wild to 570-873-0144. We're also on Instagram. Our handle is Bewildered Podcast. You can follow us to get updates, hear funny snippets and outtakes, and chat with other fans of the show. Bewildered is produced by Scott Forster with support from the brilliant team at MBI. And remember, if you're having fun, please rate and review, and stay wild.
You know, what I'm seeing out in the world is a lot of fear and a growing amount of despair. Maybe you're feeling that way too, because the ways our culture has taught us to navigate the world, to navigate our lives, they are failing us. We need a new language. We need a new set of tools to find our way individually and as a group. And I know we can still do this. I put everything I do know about it into Wayfinder Life Coach Training. And the tools that I teach there are to help people redefine how we relate to each other, how we make a living, how we do community. We can only change the world for the better if we redefine how we think. And the world needs Wayfinders now more than ever. So please go to marthabeck.com and you'll find your way.